Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Le Show Nationwide Radio, actually not just nationwide because there was Toronto in there. The North American, well, Edinburgh, this pat. The Northern Hemisphere Radio Tour has alighted this week in New York City. And you know how that fills me with glee, absolute glee. But there's wonderful news about New York, or at least in New York. News Corporation, of which so many of us are members of that fine family, is paying $50,000 a month to rent its chairman, Rupert Murdoch, an apartment here in New York City. That could get you, what, a kitchenette? Murdoch needs the company to pay his $50,000 a month rent, because otherwise he's just making $4.5 million a year plus $21 million in cash bonuses. So, you know, you're not supposed to be able to afford New York City on that, are you? Seriously? Really? With the Asian wife and everything? I don't think so. Ladies and gentlemen, before any furtherness occurs, I'm constrained to say this because it happens at some of my fine affiliates around the country almost every week. If you hear last week's show run again, it's not me. And if you want to hear this week's show, you can always go to harryshearer.com or kcow.com and get it on the internet, because I don't rerun my shows. At least, I don't rerun last week's show. That would be sad. And this is New York City. Trying to get here today, I did have to ride in a car that had to cross Fifth Avenue, which is the longitudinal middle point of the island of Manhattan. And it was close call, because there's some sort of parade. You know, they brag on Central Park all the time, and as well they should. It's a beautiful urban park. And yet, if anybody wants to have a hooray, I'm Lithuanian parade, they don't parade in the park. They make the city close the streets. Now, they don't have that many streets here. It's a narrow little island. One street, and bang, you're dead. You might as well stay, as my driver said, my vehicle driver said, I'm not even going to get out of bed tomorrow, because it's Columbus Day, you know, and there's going to be the I Grew My Nails Long parade or something. So, you know, but why wouldn't they have them in the park? Because, you know, you can't get the attention of people in the windows if you're parading in the park. I guess, me, I'd want to parade in the park, but I'm not a parader. All by way of saying hello, welcome to the show.
Autumn in New York, why does it seem so inviting? Autumn in New York, it spells the thrill of first nighting. Glittering crowds and shimmering clouds in canyons of steel. They're making me feel I'm home. It's autumn in New York that brings the promise of new love. Autumn in New York is often mingled with pain. Dreamers with empty hands, they sigh for exotic lands. It's autumn in New York. It's good to live it again. This autumn in New York transforms the slums into Mayfair. Autumn in New York, you'll need no castles in Spain. Lovers that bless the dark on benches in Central Park. It's autumn in New York. It's good to live it all.
From the other edge of America, from New York City, where the slums become Mayfair. Really? Mm-hmm. Frank said so. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. You know, the Republicans a couple weeks ago introduced a new, relatively new word into the American political vocabulary, speaking of Democrats who maintained that the war in Iraq was a bad idea and the idea of winning it was absurd. There are some Democrats that say that. In public? Yes, there are some. The Republicans introduced the term defeatocrat to upbraid them and deride them. Well, this week, ladies and gentlemen, we've seen the debut of the defeatopublicans. Dateline Washington, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said the Afghan war against Taliban guerrillas can never be won militarily. Doesn't that sound like a defeat Republican? And urge support for efforts to bring, quote, people who call themselves Taliban, unquote, and their allies into the Afghan government. That's a good idea. Just merge. It's a very Republican idea. When in doubt, merge. The Tennessee Republican said he learned from briefings that Taliban fighters were too numerous and had too much popular support to be defeated on the battlefield. This is the Republican Senate leader. You need to bring them into a more transparent type of government, Frist said. And if that's accomplished, we'll be successful. Yeah, if only we can bring the Taliban into the Afghan government, we can call that success. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Frist said asking the Taliban to join the government was a decision to be made by the Afghan president. President Karzai's spokesmen were not immediately available for comment, but laughter was heard from the... No. Not true. Senator Mel Martinez, a Republican from Florida, is considering being a defeat Republican. He said negotiating with the Taliban was, quote, not out of the question, but that fighters who refused to join the political process would have to be defeated. We're going to need to stay here a long time, Frist said of Afghanistan, and he was warned that attacks will increase. He said there appears to be an unlimited flow of Afghans and foreigners willing to pick up arms and integrate themselves with the Taliban. If they're into integration, there's no hope. Wouldn't you say, Senator Frist? And add defeat Republicans. The Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee offered a stark assessment of the situation in Iraq after a trip there this week, saying parts of the country have taken, quote, steps backwards.
Well, that's kind of progress. It's bad progress. A lot of bad people working not hard enough.
John Warner, Republican of Virginia, said the United States is at risk of losing the campaign to control Baghdad.
That's defeat Republican talk.
He told reporters Iraq's government is having trouble making strides. Well, one foot in front of, and is incapable of providing even basic human necessities to people in certain areas of the country. This is what year, and Senator Warner is discovering that? He praised U.S. efforts to keep Iraq under control. He was far less optimistic about the situation there than he had been over the past 3 years. He says he believes the United States may have to reevaluate its approach in Iraq if the situation does not improve dramatically over the next couple of months. Let's see, that would be a change of direction right after the election. Okay, that sounds about right. I assure you, says Senator Warner, in 2 or 3 months, if this thing hasn't come to fruition, we need fruit in Iraq in 2 months, ladies and gentlemen. And if this level of violence is not under control and this government able to function, I think it's a responsibility of our government internally to determine, is there a change of course we should take, Warner said. And he added, I wouldn't take off the table any option at this time, including removing the table, I guess. Finally, in the parade of defeat Republicans, ladies and gentlemen, Dateline Baquba, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, says this week U.S. officials had been arrogant and made many mistakes during the Iraq rebuilding. They've rebuilt it? Quote, it's important to recognize that mistakes have been made over the last few years. Passive voice, ladies and gentlemen. Pioneered for public usage in the Nixon administration. Mistakes have been made. There were no makers. You know, levies failed. There have been, continuing to quote the fine ambassador, there have been times, he says, when U.S. officials have behaved arrogantly and were not receptive to advice from local leaders. He did not say how many of those times were or whether there were times when they didn't do that. Quote, we have made mistakes. Oh, okay. Now he goes to active voice. We, and by we he means, I guess, you and me, ladies and gentlemen, have made mistakes in the process of rebuilding Iraq. But he continues, the path for success is clear. Thank God somebody can see that. We're committed to helping Iraq stand on its own 2 feet. So we now know for sure, ladies and gentlemen, how many feet Iraq has. The defeat Republicans for this week, the roll call, the honor roll. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. From the British newspaper The Guardian, ex-Home Secretary David Blunkett says for the first time he regrets the presentation of the intelligence dossier in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. A member of the War Cabinet, he reveals that Britain battled with U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld not to press ahead with dismantling, quote, the whole of the security, policing, administrative, and local government system. Quoting, the issue was, what the hell do you do about it? Unquote. Well, still quoting him. That was him quoting his own issue. All we could do, says Blunkett, as a nation of 60 million off the coast of mainland Europe, was to seek to influence the most powerful nation in the world. We did seek to influence them, but we were not in charge. So you cannot say that if only the government recognized what needed to be done, it would have all been different. We dismantled the structure of a functioning state. The British view was change them by all means, decapitate them even, but very quickly get the arms and legs moving. I did not take enough notice, he said, because I was Home Secretary, and I did not argue enough about what we were doing presentationally about the dossiers. These were the files of Iraqi intelligence presented to the Parliament before they voted to approve the war, ladies and gentlemen. There is no point pretending I did enough. And I was right, I just did not, unquote. People took things in good faith, he said. if for the first time ever you were going to have a vote in Parliament about going to war and you're trying to win the country over and you're trying to send signals that might end, in the end, avoid war, you get into that kind of momentum, which is very difficult to get out of. He insists Blair stood up to the president in private, although gives no examples. And more news from outside the bubble. Three times as many British soldiers have been wounded in action in Afghanistan as the British government has admitted. Defense chiefs claim it is, quote, too difficult to keep a record of every soldier injured fighting against the Taliban. It's hard sometimes to keep track of how well things are going. According to the Ministry of Defense in Britain, only 41 soldiers have been wounded in action in Afghanistan since the start of the year, despite British forces being involved in what has been described as the worst fighting since the Korean War. But a study submitted to the Ministry of Defense by the Vice President of the Royal Statistical Society has concluded the true scale of casualties has been dramatically underreported. Well, as long as it hasn't been comedically underreported. That would be a scandal, ladies and gentlemen. Patrick Mercer, the Conservative spokesman for Homeland Security, accused the British government, the Labour government, of distorting the figures to make casualty figures appear more acceptable to the public. News from outside the bubble. Ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast, but there's more about Iraq. Wouldn't you like to know some more about Iraq while everybody's talking about the pages? By the way, it's a tragedy, I think, that Representative Foley has been forced to resign from the Congress because just next year, he was planning to introduce a major new piece of legislation, the No Page Left Unturned Act, which I think... Dateline Saudi Arabia. Security in Iraq has collapsed so dramatically, according to the Saudis, that Saudi Arabia has ordered the construction of a 550-mile high-tech fence to seal off its troubled northern neighbor. We should get them to build the fence with Mexico. They know it. The huge project to build the barrier, which will be equipped with ultraviolet night vision cameras, buried sensor cables, and thousands of miles of barbed wire, will snake across the vast and remote thing. The fence will be built despite the hundreds of millions of dollars the Saudi kingdom has spent in the past 2 years to beef up patrols with Iraq. Officials now say the crisis in Iraq is so dangerous it must be physically shut out. It's from the British newspaper The Telegraph. The feeling in Saudi Arabia, says Nawaf Obaid, the director of the National Security Assessment Project of Saudi Arabia, the feeling is that Iraq is way out of control, with no possibility of stability. This is the Saudis talking, ladies and gentlemen. The urgency now, he continues, is to get that border sealed, physically sealed. The fence is a fresh sign that key allies of the United States and the Middle East are resigned to worsening violence and the possible breakup of Iraq. For Saudi Arabia, the deterioration in its northern neighbor is a security nightmare. Saudi officials are worried about so-called blowback in which Saudi insurgents in Iraq bring jihad back to the streets of Riyadh and Jeddah. But they're mostly concerned that an Iraqi civil war will send a wave of refugees south. You know, like the policy. Since late August, British commandos in the deserts of far southeastern Iraq have been testing one of the most serious charges leveled by the United States against Iran, that Iran is secretly supplying weapons, parts, funding, and training for attacks against the U.S.-led forces in Iraq. But, says the commander, Lieutenant Colonel David Labouchere, I suspect there's nothing out there, and I intend to prove it. Other British military leaders spoke as explicitly in interviews with the Washington Post, nothing to support the Americans' contention that Iran is providing weapons and training in Iraq. I myself have not seen any evidence, and I don't think any evidence exists of government-supported or instigated armed support on Iran's part, says British Defense Secretary Des Brown. The Bush administration's effort to foster a bloc of moderate Arab states, that's what we need. The moderate Arabs, ladies and gentlemen. Can we line them up, please? That was a brick wall. Several close U.S. allies bluntly told Condoleezza Rice this week they do not want to be pitted against other Arab governments and movements, according to senior Arab officials, quoted in the Washington Post. The solution, the allies told Rice, lies with stronger U.S. leadership in solving the Arab-Israeli conflict. Oh, that. They questioned whether the administration has the energy or full commitment to pull off a solution to the Palestinian issue before Bush leaves.
He's leaving office? Really?
Arab officials expressed frustration. The United States seems far more focused on Iran's nuclear program. The Saudi foreign minister called on the Bush administration to restart the Arab-Israeli peace, the Palestinian-Israeli peace process, saying, quote, there is a very short step from extremism to terrorism. And ever since the problem arose of Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the region has been destabilized, says the Saudi guy. The Saudi guy. It's a new Adam Sandler movie. And from the Christian Science Monitor, in the appearances across the U.S., President Bush has been campaigning against withdrawing troops from Iraq, arguing that to leave now would hand a victory to al-Qaeda. In a letter that has been translated and released by the U.S. military, al-Qaeda itself sees the continued American presence in Iraq as a boon for the terror network. Quote, the most important thing is that the jihad continues with steadfastness. Indeed, prolonging the war is in our interest, says the writer, who goes by the name of Atiyah. The letter was recovered in the rubble of the Iraqi house where Zarqawi was killed by a bomb. News of Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. It all makes you want to be a defeat Republican. Copyrighted term.
New York on Sunday, big city taking a nap. Slow down, it's Sunday. Life's a ball, let it fall right in your lap. If you've got troubles, just take them out for a walk. They'll burst like bubbles in the fun of a Sunday in New York. You can spend time without spending a dime watching people watch people pass. Later you pause and in one of the stores there's that face next to yours in the glass. Two hearts stop beating, you're both too breathless to speak. Love smiles her greeting, then the dream that has seen you through the week comes true on Sunday in New York. You can take a short nautical break. They've got boats by the lake for hire. If there's a storm, you just make it on home and get cozy and warm by a fire. By Monday morning, you're both agreed it was fate. As day comes dawning, if you can't pick the spot or set the date. On Sunday, New York on Sunday, so make it Sunday in New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show. You know, something else that's been going on this week over across the pond, but I find interesting because we have our own problems with becoming one society, and the advantages we've had a head start. The Brits are kind of coming to the party late, let's put it that way, because you know it looked the same for so long. Well, now it looks different. I can tell you from having been in London this summer that it's pretty amazing the number of women you see walking around London, ladies and gentlemen, in full burqa, just covered head to toe, head to tattoo. And you hope they're paying cash, because if they're, you know, writing a check or offering a credit card and the guy asks for picture ID, what do they show him? But the former British Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, guy who once said, I think he became former Foreign Secretary after opining earlier this year that attacking Iran was nuts. You can't have a guy saying that. Well, he has a weekly newspaper column. He's still a member of Parliament. And he has a newspaper column in which he said that he prefers his Muslim women constituents, you know, who come to meet him in his office, his district office, to remove the veils that cover their face. He doesn't care if they cover their hair, their shoulders, anything else. But he likes to see their face. Would those people who do wear the veil think about the implications for community relations, he asked in a radio interview following up on the editorial. I would rather that women not wear the veil, he says, because he thinks, you know, in a face-to-face conversation, the idea of face should be part of the formula. But, of course, several voices have called for Straw to apologize since the initial editorial. The chief, Hamid Qureshi, chief of the Lancashire Council of Mosques, said it was blatant Muslim bashing. Lord Narin Patel denounced him also. Rajnar Akhtar chairs the organization Project Hijab. Hijab is one of the forms of the veil. Suggested the appalling comments showed a deep lack of understanding. Now, a couple of women who do wear the veil appeared on BBC television to say that they do so not because it's a religious commandment, because apparently it's not. Although, you know, don't take your Quran from me. Not that deep into it. But they said they did it for a personal choice, for matters of personal identity. So we have to take that into consideration. Nahilia Ashraf says, obviously we want to send a loud and clear message to Jack Straw about what he said. We don't agree with what he said. It's just completely out of order. The idea that after representing Muslims for 23 years, he's now come out and said that a cloth over someone's face is stopping him from interacting is just absurd. But not all the Muslims are attacking him. Although there was an attack on Friday in Liverpool in which a woman's veil was torn from her face, and of course Jack Straw was blamed for that. Robert Davis, head of the Department of Religious Education at the University of Glasgow, said Straw's comments exposed a hypocrisy at the heart of Western societies which claim to support freedom of choice. Quote, in the West, after a long struggle, women have established the right to full autonomy in exercising personal freedom over what they wear, what they look like. Modern Western consumer culture, he continues, is sexualized, whether you see that as an achievement or a trap. We must recognize that it represents a set of values with which non-Western cultures are frequently uneasy. He concludes, the veil invites us to engage with Muslim women in other ways. Unquote. In veiled ways, I would imagine would be one of the ways. There'll be more about this moments from now here on Le Show.
Rising up. Back on the street, I did my time, I took my chances. When the distance, now I'm back on my feet, just a woman and her will to survive. It's the eye of the tiger, it's the thrill of the fight. I'm rising up to the challenge of a rival, and the last known survivor stalks his prey in the night, and he's watching us all with the eye of the tiger. Tiger. So many times it happens to fathers. You trade, I hear a passion for your glory. Don't lose your grip on the dreams of the past. You must fight just to keep them alive. It's the eye of the tiger, it's the thrill of the fight. Rising up to the challenge of a rival, and the last known survivor my time, I took my chances. In the distance, now I'm back on my feet. Just a woman and her will to survive. It's the eye of the tiger, the thrill of the fight. I'm rising up to the challenge of a rival. And the last one survivor stokes his prey in the night. And he's watching us all with the eye.
From the BBC, this is I Put It To You. I'm Edward Purdom. And tonight, the controversy over Jack Straw's call for Muslim women to put down the veil has escalated further. After the defence by several Muslim women that they wear the veil for personal, not strictly religious reasons, a native Briton has stepped forward to seek their support in his own battle for sartorial freedom. Tonight, I'm putting it to screaming Lord Such Jr., the illegitimate son of the late eccentric perennial political gadfly. Lord Such Jr., welcome to I Put It To You.
Thank you, Edward.
And I do put it to you, sir, that your so-called crusade for freedom to dress as you please in public has nothing in common with the desire of these Muslim women to veil 99% of their faces and bodies.
Well, you see, that's where you and I must agree to part company, assuming, of course, that we ever were in company previously, which I tend to doubt. But, Edward, I must insist on the commonality of my position with that of the Muslim women. They said on your very network that they wear the veil to feel more confident, less vulnerable to men viewing them as a sex object.
Yes, and as this file footage clearly shows, sir, your chosen form of public dress is to go about major streets in London clad only in a nappy.
What the Americans call a diaper, yes, sir?
Well, I put it to you, sir, that this is a travesty of their position.
Well, surely not, Edward. Once the question is what makes one feel more confident, we're really in an area of maximum personal discretion. If I say to you that strolling down Regent Street in what I must insist is a perfectly clean and fine-looking nappy is what imbues in me that same plenitude of confidence, who are you, sir, to say to me, hold, sir, you must put on some trousers and a jumper?
Well, yes, but don't you think community cohesion is challenged by your decision to stride along the avenues of commerce in a state of substantial undress?
Well, not unless my state of undress is construed to be a discouragement to others to buy more clothing. Is that where we've come to, Edward? No, sir. If a community is to embrace all the strands of diversity, then those of us who believe that we've never been better dressed than when we were first dressed need to be embraced for who we really are.
Even if the embrace is of necessity at arm's length.
Oh, certainly.
But I do put it to you, sir, that these women, many of whom insist that their choice has not been coerced either by religious dictate or by their male relatives, they say they feel freed from the constraints of having to follow a certain socially approved standard of attractiveness, the so-called sex object argument.
Well, I understand completely, Edward, and we are so on the same wavelength, so to speak, that I'm at a loss to understand what it is that you keep putting to me.
Well, are you seriously suggesting that wearing the normal adult male clothing in modern England subjects you to unwanted attention as a sex object? I put it to you that surely you're not.
No, sir, quite the contrary. The normal adult male clothing, as you call it, deprives me of nearly all the attention I desire as a sex object. Surely you don't suggest that the need for such attention is any less deserving of societal respect than the need for less such attention? If so, I would put it to you, sir, that you were being something of the fool.
But what are you to say, Lord Such Jr., to the argument that your position opens the door, as it were, to full physical nudity?
Ah, but you see, Edward, I'm exposing no socially disturbing part of my body in my chosen form of attire. Everything naughty is nicely wrapped up in white cotton for private viewing at another time. What? I just seek the personal identity, even at my rather advanced age, of a sexually attractive being, and I would suggest that to deprive me of that right to express and experience my identity in the public square is the very cause upon which I base my bond with the Muslim women of Britain.
Well, now you're not suggesting, are you, that this choice in your case has any religious motivation whatsoever?
Well, I'm sure I could find something in the Bible about humbleness of raiment and such, but just as my Muslim sisters insist on their right to a personally fulfilling physical identity, in their case one of total concealment, I insist on that same right, sir, as expressed in near-total revealment.
Revealment.
But you said I'm eccentric.
Indeed. But as a spokesman for the Borough Council have made clear, they do find it seriously disturbing to the public sense of cohesion and contentment for you to be allowed to wander down the footpath looking something like a superannuated toddler. I put it to you, does the community have no right to maintain a sense of public decorum?
Well, Edward, I must insist that this is not an issue of decorum or propriety. I think everyone who has encountered me, once they've recovered from the initial shock and sexual arousal, will tell you that my conduct, my demeanour, has been above reproach. And I'll let you in on a little secret, Edward. This isn't the way I go about my business inside my flat.
Are you putting it to me that, just as the Muslim women eschew the veil at home, that you eschew the diaper?
Oh, certainly, Edward. Were you to be fortunate enough to be invited to my rooms, you might most certainly see me caparisoned in a fine three-piece suit to watch the telly or microwave my dins, so I shan't be lectured about decorum, sir.
Well, in closing, let me just touch on the most delicate possible way on the obvious question here. When you're out and about in your chosen state of dress, do you perhaps find yourself using the nappy or diaper for the purpose for which it was originally intended? That would, I put it to you, pose an aesthetic, if not a more serious issue.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, Edward. No, of course. I'm a big boy. I'm a loo user from way back. Let me emphasize again, the choice of the nappy is one of personal identity, not functionality. In fact,
well, mercifully, before we can encounter any more detail on that subject, we have run out of time for this edition. Our thanks to Screaming Lord Such Jr. for letting us put it to him, and please join me again for the next edition of I Put It To You. Goodbye.
I'm walking on a wire and I'm falling.
Ladies and gentlemen, F is for FEMA. And, you know, Congress tried to take action this year in the wake of FEMA's poor handling, supposedly. I don't know who got that idea of the Hurricane Katrina disaster and the flood disaster that followed the hurricane in New Orleans. Did you know about that? The fact that Michael Brown, Bush's choice to lead FEMA, had been a politically connected hireling with no prior experience. So Congress established new job qualifications for the agency's director to shield FEMA from cronyism. That went into last week's Homeland Security bill, which was signed with a flourish by President Bush. The new law says the president must nominate a candidate who has, quote, a demonstrated ability in and knowledge of emergency management and not less than 5 years of executive leadership, unquote. Congress. Hours after this is from the Boston Globe, ladies and gentlemen. Hours after signing that bill into law, President Bush crossed his fingers, or actually, I guess he was crossing his fingers when he signed it, and issued a signing statement reflecting the crossing of fingers, saying he could ignore the new restrictions. Under his interpretation of the Constitution, and I think he's talking about our Constitution, but I'll have to check that out. The provision passed by Congress for qualifications to head FEMA interfered with his power to make personnel decisions. The law, Bush wrote, and that's, by the way, that's a broad interpretation. The verbiage that appeared over Bush's signature said, the law purports to limit the qualifications of the pool of persons from whom the president may select the appointee in a manner that rules out a large portion of those persons best qualified by experience and knowledge to fill the office. Bush's signing statement challenged at least three dozen laws in the giant Homeland Security bill. But the one that's cutest is the one regarding the qualifications for FEMA director. The signing statement was not included in news reports on the bill signing. It hit the White House website around 8 o'clock Wednesday night after most reporters had gone home, don't you know? Senator Susan Collins, chairwoman of the Senate's Homeland Security Committee, rejected Bush's suggestion that he can bypass the FEMA laws. She says there are numerous precedents for Congress establishing qualifications for executive branch positions, ranging from the Solicitor General post to the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. All right, that problem solved. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Yes, I'm right here. Dateline Toronto, Canada's top Mountie apologized for the, quote, terrible injustices done to a Canadian Muslim. We had this last week. All right. The news this week is that the Canadian Muslim to whom the terrible injustices were done rejected that apology and wants an apology from the Prime Minister, and he's not getting one yet. But let's turn to the apologies that matter most to us, shall we? Shan't we? Facing a tight re-election race, Representative Tom Reynolds has launched an ad campaign. He's a Republican from New York. An ad campaign to defend himself against criticism over the scandal involving Mark Foley and congressional pages. Quote, nobody's angrier and more disappointed that I didn't catch his lies. Reynolds says in his TV commercial, I trusted that others had investigated. Looking back, more should have been done, and for that, I am sorry. Unquote. Reynolds, who is head of the House Republican election effort. Reynolds says his position in the House leadership has not been compromised. But more, Dateline Scranton, Pennsylvania, Representative Don Sherwood, a Republican fighting for re-election, says in a TV ad that he is truly sorry for cheating on his wife. But he denies ever abusing the woman he had the affair with. So it's six a dozen out another. In the ad, he acknowledges that the affair nearly cost him the love of his wife and daughters. He says his family has worked through it because of, quote, my deep regret, our love, and the fact that the allegation of abuse was never true. I never wavered from my commitment to reduce taxes, he adds. Denny Hastert. Sure, Denny Hastert apologized, too. Ultimately, the buck stops here. I'm deeply sorry this has happened, and the bottom line is we're taking responsibility, says Hastert, after blaming Democrats and ABC News. Avril Lavigne, you know who she is. Sure you do. Has agreed that spitting at the paparazzi is not a good thing to do. She issued a statement apologizing after she and her husband clashed with paparazzi in Los Angeles. Lavigne spat at photographers in two separate incidents last week. She apologized for her, quote, behavior with the paparazzi. However, her apology posted on her website indicated she meant no offense to her fans, not the paparazzi. She says it's trying at best dealing with their insistent intrusions. She was the voice of Heather the opossum in Over the Hedge? Sure, you know her. CNN reporter Sean Calebs interviewed Representative Alexander of Louisiana. He sponsored the page who received the overly friendly email from Foley. Alexander said, quote, my job was to protect the young man and his parents, and I failed, and I apologize for that. The young man has begun to get some threats, unquote. Okay, back to the trivial people. Sienna Miller, in Pennsylvania, shooting The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, is backtracking from her comments about the former steel town, which she referred to in Rolling Stone as a term which rhymes with Pittsburgh but begins with S-H. Will you pity me when you're back in your funky New York apartment and I'm still in Pittsburgh? She said to the magazine. I need to get more glamorous films. But now, in a statement sent out via her PR person, Miller says, I want to apologize for my comments, which seem to have been misconstrued and taken out of context. I was referring to the fact that we were shooting almost all night on this film, and none of us have had an opportunity to fully explore the city. What I have seen of it is beautiful. I sincerely apologize and hope people realize that conversations can be easily manipulated in print. Unquote. In yet another dramatic incident at Los Angeles International Airport, two Two aircraft came so close to colliding on a runway this week that one pilot can be heard hyperventilating on air traffic control tapes. After the incident, a shaken tower controller can be heard on the radio apologizing to the SkyWest pilot and asking him immediately to leave the runway to make room for a landing aircraft. Quote, SkyWest 6430, I apologized. We never talked to the Gulfstream. He crossed without a clearance, says the controller. I apologize if you make a right turn and exit the runway. Adding, of course, why do you think they call it LAX? More apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. I think just a couple more. Actually, one more. The midday host of KNDD Seattle. You know I love radio apologies. They're so good. The midday host, DJ No Name. Aside from, he's not apologizing for his lack of imagination. No. He's apologized for playing Weird Al Yankovic's Amish Paradise, a parody of Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise following the fatal school shootings at an Amish schoolhouse. Vice President of Entercom Seattle, Jerry McKenna, says No Name had been, quote, less respectful of the event than he should have been. He added, we are dealing with it internally, by which I guess he means management is taking antacids. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. You know that Representative Foley, the central figure in the Page scandal that's enveloping Capitol Hill, has entered rehab for his alcoholism, don't you know? And coincidentally, you know, it's New York City. I was just walking by a theater where I think they're in previews on a new show called 6 Weeks in Rehab, of which this may be one of the songs.
So you sent improper emails to that tempting little page, and you only find out later that the tramp is underage. Well, you can answer all the questions, dig yourself real deep, or you can check in at the one place where they'll never hear a peep. Welcome to rehab, rehab. You can be just as private as the she-crab. It's not a million miles from your neighborhood, but get the rehab habit, 'cause it feels real good, real good. So you got caught driving reckless, you ratted out the Jews. Now you got a speeding ticket and those angry agent blues. Well, you can hold one more press conference and apologize again, or you can check in at the one place where silence is your friend. Why not hang out in rehab, rehab? More private than wearing the knee jab. It's a place where you live like you know you should. Get the rehab habit, 'cause it feels really good. You know Whitney took the chimney, Mr. Limbaugh took the bus, Patrick Kennedy didn't drive himself.
No!
Pat O'Brien stayed inside. Kate Moss stayed out of people and us. It's rehab, rehab. How to avoid the TV gab.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, as the shadows lengthen here at the Le Show Dome, time for one item News of the Warm. Won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Okay, put a sock in it, Glenn. The climate of the nine northeastern U.S. states could become like that of the hotter south by the end of the century unless greenhouse gas emissions are steadily lowered. This, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. The Union of Blasé Scientists has yet to report. This is their most detailed regional report yet on the issue. It says that longer, much hotter summers, warmer winters with less snow and other changes could put significant strain on the power grid and healthcare system. The impact could be lower if carbon dioxide emissions are reduced by 3% a year. The good news is it would make people in New York talk slower. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of The Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download at audible.com/theshow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like you being aware of my new novel, Not Enough Indians, out now, if you'd agree to join with me then.
In other words, buy the book.
Thank you. Would you do that? All righty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Chicago desks. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com, and a tip of the Le Show chapeau as well to Pam Halstead and to Shari Deutsch of CBS Radio here in New York City. I'm going to go out and try to cross Fifth Avenue. Wish me luck. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from Manhattan.